Okay, everybody, we're going to get started here. There's been a bit of a program change, if you are following along in the program, which is Dr. Lori Peek is not here, so in her place is her standby, which is me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to combine, actually, the first two presentations together. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a youth recovery and the Shoreline Project, which are really linked presentations. And then when I'm done, we're going to hear from Dr. Tom Chandler, and then after that from Dr. Lauren Clay. Because there are three of us, the way we're going to work this is there are, let's say each presentation will be about 20 minutes or so. First, maybe a little bit longer because it's combining two. We're going to open it up to a few questions afterwards, and then when Dr. Clay is done, we're going to do a longer Q&A. Okay? So I'd like to actually set the stage for us a little bit first, which is to think about disaster science, because you've got three presentations here that are very distinct, but in some ways we're all really related to one another. So if you think about the calculus of disaster risk, you look at a very basic equation, and the most simple equation is risk equals hazard times vulnerability, but if you think a little bit more about it, it gets slightly more complicated. So the risk could be the risk of death or disability from a disaster. It could be economic loss. It could be the failure to recover is the risk of a disaster. That's the outcome or the outcome variable that we would be interested in disaster science. When you look at the hazards, people will look at, well, what type of hazard is this? What is the magnitude? What is the force? What is the exposure to it? When you look at vulnerability, there are many different dimensions of vulnerability to hazards. There's physical vulnerability. There's social. There's cultural. There's economic vulnerabilities. There's ecological vulnerabilities. There are all sorts of vulnerabilities. There are also ways to adjust or mitigate those vulnerabilities. You can prepare ahead of time. You can surveil a population. You can vaccinate them so that they are not as susceptible to an infectious disease. You can raise their home so they're not as susceptible to floods, etc. There are all sorts of adjustments. And then there are response systems, those governmental and non-governmental, formal and informal entities that respond when the event occurs. And the question about the response systems is they can independently have an impact on the outcomes as well. They can reduce the death and disability. They can accelerate the movement towards recovery if those response systems are competent, capable, equitable, fair, functional, coordinated. So, this is the big picture. We are not covering all the pieces, but it's like the elephant where we're trying to describe the elephant by feeling different pieces of it. And so what Dr. Chandler is going to talk about is the response systems, and he's going to focus on what were the response systems in Hurricane Sandy, how competent, capable, equitable are they? And so beginning to understand that piece so that we can begin to look at, is it related to better outcomes. Dr. Clay is going to look in the vulnerabilities at sort of the collective levels, sort of the social institutional, social support levels, and ask the question, are they related to better outcomes, such as the ability to recover more quickly? And what I'm going to do is focus on youth in disasters, youth as a particular population that has its own vulnerability and its own resiliency. That is in some ways distinct and that can be activated or facilitated. So that's the big picture to sort of set the stage for our three presentations. So let's begin with this now combined presentation, which is both an overview of youth and disaster recovery and a very quick tour of the resiliency literature, and then a much tighter focus on the Shoreline Youth Empowerment Project. I have no financial interests to disclose. And now that we have audio and video, I'd like to show you a little video that was just uploaded last week. And this is going to show you a bit of our shoreliners from both the New York City chapter that we have interacting with the Gulf Coast chapters. And you're going to hear a lot more about Shoreline in a few minutes, but this was done in our effort to kind of begin to bridge Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy. So hopefully this will work. Loud. These were all recorded essentially on the kids' smartphones. They did this in a week. We gave them a sort of as part of our curriculum, as you're going to hear about, we give them projects, and they operate as a network where they're trying to sort of bridge the gap between what happened to them in their home communities and what happens in other communities, and to begin to understand for themselves what are the impacts of disasters. What can the kids in New York City who went through Sandy learn from the kids in the Gulf Coast who went through Katrina? And this was one of their projects. So the audio-video quality is not great, but it's pretty impressive for the fact that they did it in 1 week on their smartphones. So let's start with three misperceptions about kids and disasters. The first one is that kids are resilient, period. That don't worry, it's okay, they'll bounce back. No matter what, they're very resilient. To some extent, that's true, but it's not an absolute. Number two is the misperception that they are absolutely vulnerable, that kids are, you know, all of them are vulnerable to the impacts of a disaster. Not an absolute there either. And then the last misperception is that disasters are an equal opportunity event that will affect everybody equally. But as we know, there are lots of different contextual factors, lots of social and structural elements in our society that don't necessarily allow people to be exposed or permit them to be exposed equally when a disaster happens. So let's take a step back and look at this somewhat complicated diagram, which comes from Uri Bronfenbrenner, when he looks at what are all the effects on a child's development? How do you begin to describe it? And the way he sort of laid it out, and this is sort of a classic look of the ecological model, is that there are all sorts of things that go into a child's development, from the biologic and genetic up through the systems that are these mesosystems, is what he called them, peer groups, school groups, family groups, and then the families themselves live within larger exosystems. And then above that, you get macro systems, which could include the policy environment as well. So all, and their chronology also affects a child's development. All of these things are playing into a child's development. And when we look at this question then, of, and we take this notion of development and pair it up with disaster, we ask, okay, what about exposure? Are children uniquely exposed and affected by disasters? And so, you know, we can think of a few somewhat recent disasters and how each one had a different effect. This is the Superdome, obviously, and there were 160,000 kids that were displaced from their homes for 4 or more months in the aftermath of Katrina. 160,000. A number of them did not actually go to school for months or even that whole year because of this disruption. So you can begin to think about the disruption in the systems in their lives. Another one would be Hurricane Sandy. And here you've got people that are being evacuated because they did not evacuate themselves, so maybe they were leaving as the floodwaters were coming up. And you have the issue of what does the child remember when the home is filling up with water? Or you could have a tornado from Moore, Oklahoma, that levels a school and kills a number of kids in the school. And what is it like for the kids that are left in the school? What is it like for kids in other schools in Tornado Alley? How do they think about it when they hear these kind of stories? So when we look at the overall literature on children and disasters, there are a couple of things that are worth keeping in mind. Number one is that there are enduring impacts of these disasters on children, and so that it's not just the immediate effect. And in fact, the effects may not be expressed for many, many years. Sometimes the mental health effects can last for 5 years or longer, but then there can be morbidities that express in the adult life course that, you know, are coming 20, 30, 40 years later. I mean, there's some very famous studies, such as the Dutch famine study from World War II, where current epidemiologists have looked at the relationship between lack of access to food and nutrition amongst kids who are actually, this is prenatal and perinatal, and then the spike in schizophrenia and other mental health problems 30, 40, and 50 years later. So disasters can have an enduring effect. Number two, children's health and well-being is highly contingent upon a series of linked and not always linked social systems. So they are not always their own agent. They don't have their own voice and their own agency. They can, but they don't usually have it. And lastly, children and youth want to be actively engaged in their own recovery, and that is something that we often don't allow for and don't have mechanisms to embrace. So a very quick review of about 20 to 30 years of resilience research in one slide. Wave one was that the initial work that was done on kids was, why are some kids resilient to very stressful or toxic environments and others not? What are the individual level characteristics in that particular child that made that child likely to survive and thrive? Usually at the beginning it was the children of schizophrenic parents was the first major cohort of resilience research. Why did they manage to survive and do okay, and particularly some of them more than others? And we'll come to what some of the factors were. Then the wave two was, well, what were the social processes that are related to these individuals? It's not just the individual kid, but all of the social aspects of the world around them. Then wave three was, well, what can we do to activate, foster, and enhance resilience in kids? And wave four is this notion of from neurons to neighborhoods, how do we begin to collect, this is the epigenetic argument, how do we begin to collect and understand and analyze the biological impacts of stressors on biological systems in relationship with social systems that then express and articulate themselves with psychological behavioral aspects, the resilience factors. We are just now in between waves three and four. Four is very new. There's not a lot of work there. It's the beginnings of it. So there are two basic ways that we think about how do we design resilience programs. This is a complicated slide, but it boils down to one of two ways. Are we preventing or are we treating? A is a prevention. In other words, let's make the kids proactively more adaptive, more responsive, more resilient, more capable of coping before something happens. B is really the treatment model, which is the kids have some psychopathology, let us go in and see what we can do to reduce that, to address it. And the questions are always, you know, which is the direction? This is a classic public health argument in some ways, too. Is it better to prevent or to treat when you have both? If you treat, do you lead to secondary prevention because now people are not going to be as likely to have the impact? Or is it better to spend a lot of effort on the prevention so they don't have the psychopathology? And how do you activate a child's resilience? So when one of the things we did was we looked at a lot of different programs, policies, research, and did a quick analysis to see what are the different ways that we as domestically, at least have, for the most part domestically, have come up with ways to activate children's resilience. So sometimes it's through extemporaneous policy decisions. So in Joplin, Missouri, when an EF5 tornado came in and devastated the town, it was a town of 50,000 people, and a third of the housing was destroyed. 6 of the 10 schools were destroyed. The high school was destroyed, and this happened in the summertime. The school superintendent said, 2 days after the tornado, he said, in 87 days, we are starting school as normal. And it was a very bold and some would have said crazy thing to say that in 87 days he could reconstitute 60% of the infrastructure he needed for a school district with 6,000 kids and get it back up and running. He did. He galvanized the community. They were focused. And the argument would be this was definitely a resilience activation mechanism for the kids and the community. Policy advocacy and community engagement. There are lots of different efforts, not lots. There are some efforts out there to improve the resilience of communities. Some Save the Children, Red Cross, CARI. There are a number of them that, you know, are really trying to get into communities. It's sort of like a healthy communities approach and try to enhance resilience for multiple populations, including kids. It could be through specific programs and interventions that either happen before the disaster that are moderators or after the disaster that are risk-activated moderators. So, for example, in New Orleans, there is a terrific program called the Rethinkers. Has anybody here heard of the Rethinkers? So it was started after Katrina amongst middle school students, and it was essentially a chance for them to take responsibility for coming up with better policies. So they started with asking the question, and it was led by an adult, but had the kids do the whole thing. Okay, what's the problem in your school? And the kid said, the food sucks. The food is terrible. And they said, well, okay, well, let's talk about that. Let's get to what are the fundamental questions. And they started asking about school food policy, cafeteria policies, the economics of food. And they taught the kids, and they then did a survey of kids across the school district in New Orleans, and they reported on it. They had a report card about which school had the best food. And it really taught the kids science, policy, advocacy, nutrition. I mean, it was a nice little thing. And it was all in the guise of help them feel like they have a voice and they have agency. And it can also happen, resilience activation, through providers and the workforce. And these are just a couple that have been employed in post-disaster settings. The Joplin Child Care Task Force and the Children's Health Fund, which does a lot of work in post-disaster settings. So let's get to the short list of what are the individual factors most associated with the child being resilient. Positive self-identity, self-efficacious, good sense of self-worth, high self-esteem, executive control and self-regulation, the ability to really govern their actions. This is almost like the marshmallow test, which many of you are probably familiar with, the ability to delay gratification if you think that you're going to get a better outcome. Coping skills, supportive relationships. If you have supportive adults, peers, and siblings, that makes a huge difference in your ability to be resilient. The opportunities for pro-social behavior, the ability to help others. Having a positive worldview. If you are hopeful, if you have faith, sometimes religious faith, if you believe in community, if you have a good understanding of the hazards and catastrophes so they don't seem just too random to you, so that there's an attribution of cause that makes sense, well, then all of these things will lead to you, the child, let's say, being able to be more resilient. And the stability that you need in your life needs to be the stability of parents, households, institutions, communities, and social routines. These are the things that if you could put all of these things together, you are far more likely to have resilient children. And so let's hold that. We're going to come back to it. And now I'm going to sort of take a slight turn. That was the overview section. And now what I want to do is sort of bring it all the way down to a case study, which is the Shoreline Project from which you saw the video before. So we'll start with the notion that in the Gulf Coast, the kids, and particularly the kids that we've been talking to, when we asked them and we surveyed them, on average, they experienced 3.4 disasters in their very young lifetime. Major disasters is what we're talking about. So if you think about it here in the Gulf, you could look at, you know, from 2005 till today, Katrina, Rita, Wilma, there's a series of fairly significant hurricanes, tropical storms, well, actually all hurricanes that have had devastating effects on different areas around here. And then on top of that, they had the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So these are kids who have been living in a region that have had a constant barrage of disasters. And so for our research, we started with two questions that were posed to us by a funder, the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. They said to us, okay, where were the children most exposed and affected by the oil spill? And number two, what issues were they confronting as a result? And what can be done or what do they need in response? And so we began by, first, they asked us to look across four states, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. So we had to narrow the view because this is a little bit much. We created an impact score combining oil spill data and BP claims data to try and identify hot spots where there were more likely to be an impact. We identified 15 hot spots. We went and did a household survey in using a randomized cluster survey sampling. We knocked on 6,800 doors, interviewed 1,437 parents of kids. And amongst the things that we found out is that one in every two households with children reported lost income from the oil spill, and one in every four parents reported the kids having mental health distress. So this was the survey component of our effort. And what we did was we took then these, we went from, you know, first identifying the 15 communities across the four states, and then based on those 15 communities, we found in the 15 where were the four communities that the parents were most concerned, and we went back into them for a qualitative research effort where we did focus groups, key informant interviews, etc. So we went to Lafourchean Grand Isle, south of here. We went to New Orleans East. We went to Gulfport, Mississippi, and Biola-Battery, Alabama. And everywhere we went, we took one of these with us for each of those communities. It was a board, a poster board, and we would put it up in each of our focus groups and our key informant interviews, and it was particular to their community. This one is Gulfport's, and we said, okay, this is what the survey says. Help us understand the story behind the numbers. So we said, here's the exposure that we found, here are the health outcomes that we found. So if you look on the left side, you could see that we showed them for your area, Gulfport, compared to the four-state region of Florida to Louisiana, where we surveyed, 18% of the households with kids were exposed to oil, tar bowls, or dispersant, which was the same as everybody else. But when you look at lost income, or lost a job, 54% in Gulfport lost a job compared to 41% in the other region. When we look at the health status on the right side of the screen, we would say to them, well, it was pretty similar in terms of skin problems. When you look at breathing problems, the kids in Gulfport, 33%, said they had breathing problems compared to 18 across the four. And then mental health, it was twice as high. And so we would say, this is what we heard in our survey work. Can you help us understand what was going on in your community? And this represents sort of who we talk to. We talk to kids, parents, teachers, nurses, physicians, health administrators, community leaders, politicians, community advocates. We covered a lot of territory to try and understand what was going on. And the things that we heard was that, one, you can't disentangle the oil spill from all the other disasters that have occurred. You saw before how many stressors there were. They don't live in a vacuum. There's an economic recession. There were questions of how do you translate into these all these complicated social, educational issues. And on top of all of that, there were the mental and physical health issues that the kids had. There was a lot of truancy and delinquency amongst the kids because a lot of them were latchkey kids. The parents were economically stressed, leaving the kids home alone. We heard plenty of times of 8-year-olds home alone watching the 3-year-old sibling. That was not uncommon. A lot of drug and alcohol use on both the parents and the kids. Fighting in a corrosive community, meaning corrosive community is a term coined by sociologists when you have compensation, like from BP, that is not equally distributed, or there's the perception that it's not equally distributed, and people are fighting for resources. And it leads to not a good feeling of collective spirit. It leads to a corrosive community. And there was a lot of risky sexual behavior amongst the kids. So one thing we heard from one person was the only thing to do around here is go fishing, get high, or get pregnant. And you can't go fishing anymore, so you figure out what they're doing. That's what we heard. And this we heard in an area where one out of every 11 of the girls in the high school was pregnant. 90 pregnant kids, girls, in that high school. One out of 11. So what do kids need? Well, we created this program called Shoreline. We figured, okay, based on our research, they need skills, hope, opportunity, recovery in order to, and to do this through engagement. So that's the shore in Shoreline. And if you go back to that short list that I listed before and you look at what were the resilience factors, you'll see that a lot of these resilience factors are now embodied in the Shoreline program. We're trying to teach these kids the coping skills. We're trying to give them lots of opportunities for pro-social behavior. We're trying to provide ways that they can have a positive worldview. And we're trying to create ways that they have agency so that they can create stability in their own lives. So this is the tagline, by the way, is youth helping youth recover from disaster. We were inspired by three models in particular. One of them is the Posse Foundation. And they're a terrific group that's been around for over 20 years, started by Debbie Beal. And the notion was that a lot of kids don't go to college because they're missed. They're missed by the college system. And when they do manage to get in, if they're by themselves, they flounder and they can't make it. And she talked to one kid 25 years ago, a kid from a minority community who got into a really good school and said, "Why couldn't you stay there?" And he said, "I could have stayed if I had my posse with me." And so she said, "Uh-huh." And she created a program that built posses of 10 kids in these communities, and they would go, all 10, to major universities. They started with Vanderbilt was the first, and now they're at like 50 universities around the country, and they go all 10 together. They recruit them in high school. They support them. They get the college to agree to take all 10. The 10 go, and then they have multiple posse cohorts in these colleges. So you can have 40 posse kids, 10 freshmen, 10 sophomores, juniors, seniors, etc., in any different college. They support one another. It's a terrific built-in framework for a network, how to promote youth leadership. That was one inspiration. The second inspiration for us was the sustainability workshop in Philadelphia. These were kids who came from different high schools in Philadelphia. Not, as they would say, we're not the kids who are like the high-achieving kids. They were just kids. Randomly sort of interested in getting into a different field or a different environment, and for their for the sustainability workshop, for their senior year in high school, they could go to the workshop, and it was all project-based learning. No classrooms. They came in, they came up with problems, and as teams, they figured out how to solve problems. So this group that we were so inspired by built something called land rafts. They heard about the Haitian earthquake. They decided that they wanted to figure out how to build housing units that were completely modular and off the grid so that they were self-sustained with solar panels, composting toilets, little electrical systems. They designed it all by themselves. They taught themselves AutoCAD. They taught themselves integrated circuit wiring and soldering. They had none of this, you know, background, and they taught themselves all of it, and they built it themselves. Very inspiring to us to see how project-based learning can work. And then the last one that was really inspiring to us in Queens was a young gentleman named Milan Taylor, who started the Rockaway Youth Task Force before Sandy as a way to engage kids in a very socioeconomically distressed environment and get them more engaged in community service. And he was doing pretty well with it, and then Sandy hit, and hit the Rockaways very hard, and he mobilized his group like it was nobody's business. And he got not just the youth in the Rockaways, but he managed to get thousands of people to come and help. Help in the response, help in the recovery. Now they're building community gardens. And he was very inspiring. So we drew the inspiration from Shoreline from all three of these, and in fact we drew all of them onto our youth and national advisory boards as well. And we have a mission and vision. So our vision is to develop a network of youth who help themselves, their families, their schools, their communities, and youth in other communities recover from disaster. They do it by building powerful connections with each other and with trusted adults and leaders. And we help them to develop skills, foster hope, and capitalize on opportunities. And we do it by engaging the schools, getting the principals and teachers on board. We develop material and curriculum. We give them a curriculum that runs through our project-based learning, runs through three main modules: a Who Am I curriculum, which gets at social identity, a Who Are We, which gets at a collective identity and social resilience, and then also the Capstone Project, which is the main project, where they're sort of asking what's the strength and how do we share it. We recruit the students. We have between 60 and 80 students in the network right now. I'm going to skip the recruitment video first for the sake of time. If we have time afterwards in all of our presentations, I'll show you the recruitment video. And then so they go into this project-based learning. And just to sort of describe what the key milestones have been for the program, we begin the academic year, because it's all scheduled around an academic year. We're in our second academic year right now. We begin with a kickoff summit. So we began with our first kickoff summit in September 2013 in Mississippi, right on the Gulf, and we got the kids together. We did all sorts of team-building exercises. We broke them into multi-specialty teams so that there was a design team, a build team, a management team, a communication team, a logistics team, so that they begin to understand, first of all, how to network with one another, what their own interests were. They sorted themselves into these teams. It was a little bit like Harry Potter and the Sorting Hat to get them into these little teams. And then we had them identify problems. We assigned them to the teams. We had them come up with problem statements. And then they had to come back to us with problem statements of what are the things that youth are affected by in a disaster. And they had 10 minutes to do it. That's the other thing we learn is kids work really fast. And you give them a very tight time limit, they do much better. 10 minutes, you're in teams, come up with problems. They work really fast. They jotted all these things down. And then we said, okay, you've got the problems. Now you've got 20 minutes to come up with solutions. Go back to your teams, build a consensus, come focus on a solution, and answer, is it going to be a feasible solution? Will it be achievable? And can you export it to another community outside your own? Because if you can accomplish all of these things, then it's something that we want in our Shoreline network. And then report back to us. And they did. They did this all within 20 minutes, you know, and they constituted themselves and they came up with their projects. And that was our kickoff summit to orient them. And then through the course of the year, they had chapter meetings. They went through their curriculum. They had school-based activities. They had community-based activities. Here they're interviewing the Gulfport mayor from the Gulfport High School. We made school visits to them to kind of keep them oriented. And so we moved from kickoff to a capstone summit at the end of the academic year. So in May, we went to Loyola University here in New Orleans, and we brought all the kids together. And by the way, if you want to get kids engaged in anything besides giving them food, is tell them, and we're going to take you on travel trips for free. And so you get to go to college campuses, also chosen quite specifically because we want them to see college campuses and begin to get that vibe of being on a college campus. So here we are at the Capstone Summit, and these are the things that they came up with in terms of their problems and solutions. So one problem was, and this was from Ben Franklin here in New Orleans, the problem was the emotional aftermath of a disaster can be a difficult time for adults, youth, and children. Young children exposed to a disaster are often unable to articulate their feelings. It took us a long time to get them to articulate a problem statement. Their solution? Artsy, which is a program in which teens address younger kids' emotional issues through art and play activities. Very clever, and they're doing it right now with a middle school and or an elementary school nearby because they're testing it. They're trying to find other students to train them, etc. So it's not just an exercise. They're putting it into practice. Problem. The time demands on parents and caregivers after a disaster mean that kids need guidance, attention, and knowledge and skill building in which to be engaged. This was Gulfport, Mississippi. Solution, Camp Hope Waves. The teens run daycare, and they also built an aquaponics system. They actually had a double-barreled intervention. It was very clever, very complicated. Problem, high-risk communities are not adequately prepared for a disaster. So this was South Lafourche. Teens Enhancing Awareness, or T, combining a preparedness activities and resources with post-disaster community service. And the last one was post-disaster settings are often places where there's little stable power and people have a hard time cooking nutritious food. So the kids in Bryant High School in Alabama came up with no power, no problem, cooking without power, where you could take a cardboard box, aluminum foil and a hanger, some briquettes, make an oven out of it, and then they had a cook-off and a cooking competition where they brought the community together and taught them how to make them and how to judge it on taste and nutrition. So we had this Capstone Summit. We did award one of them, the Capstone Award. It did go to Bryant for their no cooking, hungry, no power, no problem. This shows them at work a little bit. And part of this also is we want to evaluate how well this is working. And so hypothetically, what we're doing is we're looking to increase their decision-making skills, their analytical skills, their communication skills, and their hopefulness scores. And we've got a case control methodology, which what we're hoping to find is that the cases, obviously, are increasing in each one of these domains, while the controls are not increasing at the same rate. While we're waiting to finalize this, though, we've done some qualitative research also. We've asked the kids, particularly the ones who are returning Shoreliners this year, well, what did you get out of Shoreline? And so there were four things they told us. Number one, they said, it helped me write my college application essay. That's important. That was good. Good that they were actually writing the essay. It allowed us as teens to see we have skills. We need to develop them, but we can get there through group effort. And those of us who are shy are really starting to open up. I'm learning that the shy people tend to be really smart when they open up. Then there's this notion of hope. I've learned that youth have a voice. A lot of parents teach us we are not old enough to speak out, but we are. Because of Shoreline, I'm thinking bigger. I was thinking just about a two-year college, but now I realize I can do more. We learned that even though we have big ideas, we really can do these things that help people, and it is inspiring. And opportunities and insights. This has connected me to youth and adults I would not have otherwise met. It's opened my eyes to the genius other people around me have. From the first summit, knowing the youth leaders has made a big difference, especially hearing Milan from the Rockaway Youth Task Force made a big difference to me. And we learn how disaster shapes our culture. The last thing is the process itself. And so one said it's not just about the tasks, but how they all fit together. And we pretty much always work in circles, either as one large group or in smaller groups, but always the circle. So clearly we feel like we're on the right track for hitting that short list that I had put up before. And that's really the notion. This is our kickoff summit in Mississippi last year. And what I've listed up here are at least three resources or citations from work that we've done that articulate this. If you want this, I'm happy to send it. This will also be on whatever APHA has afterwards. This will be saved to the slides. So with that, I'm going to stop and just open it up for two questions, maybe, if there are, and then we'll move to the next speaker. Any questions?